This is the Alternative Leader Podcast with Mary Williams, inspiring the leaders of today, getting to the grit and discovering the gold with powerful insights and learnings, helping us to lead with strength, determination, and compassion.
Welcome to the Alternative Leader Podcast. My name is Mary Williams and I'm the Mind Architect. Today's guest is Lucy Barkus. Lucy works in leadership and is author of the book Leader X. She also has her own podcast and courses that she runs too. But what I'm really here to speak to Lucy about is the fact that her life from an incredibly young age was filled with challenges, not just one or two, but several, at an incredibly young age. It's often that we look at our lives and assume that those challenges are things that have changed us for the worse. But Lucy is just an absolute ray of sunshine and somebody who certainly the challenges she's been through, she has turned around and, as she said, made them her gift. I'm so looking forward to sharing with you Lucy's story and how you can turn your challenges around and make them gifts too. So Lucy, one of the things that interested me about your story is that you've not just had one challenge all the way through, that there's been multiple challenges in your life. And I think that that's very powerful because I think most of us like to presume there'll be no challenges in our life for a start. And then when we have one, we almost feel like we've paid our service and we've done our, you know, great. Okay, I went through that awful thing and now, you know, life is going to be good to me. And certainly reading through the information, you know, that you sent me about coming on the podcast, it was sort of one thing after another, after another, after another. So I'm interested, obviously, for you to share as much as you want to about the challenges you have gone through. But what's your kind of view of life and challenge and challenges and how that kind of how that helps us possibly?
Yeah, it's a really interesting thing because I think I said to you when we were when I was just introducing my story, I guess, that I didn't realize how my outlook was until my friend in our late 20s, who'd had a series of miscarriages and I was pregnant again, turned around to me and said, "You've had it so easy, you don't know what pain is." Mm. And I looked back and I thought, wow, you know, yeah. I've had all these series of events that have happened to me, you know, from the moment I was born almost. And yeah, there's something about me that doesn't dwell on those things. Mm. And just, you know, we'll go into my story a little bit in a moment. Mm. But I always remember even when my parents split up, and it was back in the early 80s. So I was about the only child whose parents had split up. And I used to say, "No, it's great. I get two Christmases and I get two lots of presents and two holidays every year." So I think I'd always seen the positive side of everything rather than dwelling. Mm. However, that said, fast forward to when I was about 40, and then I think life did catch up with me, and I then did have to address the pain almost. But my mechanism has always been to, pain will happen, trauma will happen, things won't go your way, but you can choose to be a victim or a victor. And I always chose to see the rainbows in the storm. Mm. But yeah, I know my journey isn't over. I'm midway through my life and I've had some challenges and they'll keep coming because that's just life, isn't it?
It's interesting. I was on the train a couple of weeks ago coming back from Brighton and I met the UK's oldest comedian, still practicing, a lovely woman called Lynn Ruth Miller. So do look her up. She's 87 and still doing stand-up comedy. And she has written a book called, I think it's called something like Growing Old Outrageously. And I was reading in it and she was saying that there's a Greek quote which goes along the lines of, the worst thing that you can ever do for someone is give them an easy first 40 years. Because basically they're then just not prepared for the rest of their life.
She is so spot on. And, you know, it's even with my children as I'm trying to grow them and help them develop. Mm. I teach them resilience. I sort of like push them out there in the world and I'm not going to go and save them and try and protect them. Yeah. They will fall out with their friends. They will get their heart broken. Mm. They won't get that job or that exam grade potentially. Life is full of failures. But if you had everything easy and it was all life and roses, I don't think you'd actually really enjoy the real sweet moments. No. That's the way I've always thought about it. Mm. How can you know what pure joy and happiness is if you've never experienced the other end of it?
I agree. And I think years ago I was doing interviews on LinkedIn and I spoke to this lovely woman, but she was in her early 30s. In fact, I think she might have been 30. And we got to the point where I sort of said, you know, what is your challenge? And she said, oh, I haven't had one. And I said, you must have had something, you know, like a career challenge or, something. And she went, to be honest, I've lived a really easy life. And she said, and it really worries me. She said, I'm so worried that like if one of my parents die or something awful happens, she said, I have zero resilience. I've never had to build it. And actually, although she was lovely, she wasn't the most engaging person to speak to.
She got no stories, no empathy
no content. And lovely. But also I thought it was interesting that, you know, in some respects, the charmed life wasn't the charmed life because she was so worried about when something went wrong.
It's as Brené Brown calls it, that joy foreboding. You're waiting for the slipper to drop, aren't you? Yeah. Which is probably worse.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. But so tell us a bit about your story and the kind of multiple challenges that you've gone through.
Okay, so I was born in 1977. So, and I'm telling you that just to put a bit of context around the time and the things that were happening. I was born into a lovely rural community, really great, amazing safety with a big family. And so it was always cousins and aunties and uncles and everything around me. So it was really blessed in that respect. And we lived in this beautiful house. My dad was a builder, so he'd taken this property and turned it into this dream house. But he wasn't very good at asking for the money from clients he worked for. So I think money, I mean, it was the late 70s, early 80s, money was tough anyway. Mm. Lived in this big, beautiful house, but actually were very cash poor. So my mum started doing night shifts at the local factory. And I have a vague memory of saying goodbye to her after tea time and being really upset. It was just my life and you got on with it. However, it must have been, a few months later, my mum had to go into hospital. She'd got some dodgy cells on her ovaries, which now is an in and out procedure. Back then it was, a couple of weeks in hospital. So off my mum went to hospital. And I've got to admit, I don't remember much of this. I've just got little flashbacks. Yeah. But then my dad's mistress just moved in. So literally my mum went off to hospital. There's me as a four and a half year old. And suddenly there's this other woman living in our house.
Oh my gosh.
So I've tried to process this and have these flashback memories and stuff. And I realized that actually that's created this people pleaser in me because I had to get this person on my side. Mm-hmm. And also there was chaos going on around me. And so I had to learn how to keep everyone happy and not be any trouble to anybody and be the glorious good girl.
Oh my gosh.
But then, there was lots of sadness. And I had this real vivid memory of sleepwalking down the stairs and my dad coming to me and sort of turning me around and saying, go back to bed. And then I did probably about 2 or 3 years ago, I kind of did some hypnotic, memories.
Yes.
And actually when it came more vivid to me, because I heard some screaming and some shouting,
right,
and it must have disturbed me and I felt unsafe. And then I was just told to go away and back to my room. So again, all these fractured memories of confusion, and literally my life overnight just turned upside down. And when my mum came out of hospital then, she was essentially homeless, and she actually went and stayed while she was in recovery at the mistress's ex-husband's, because they were actually the four of them were best friends and they did everything together.
Couldn't write it, could you?
I know. So they kind of did this wife swap sort of thing. But my mum obviously was in recovery, but it was in a one-bedroom small flat. So we couldn't go and live with my mum. So we stayed living in this house. And I think it must have been for about 6 months, because obviously you don't just sell a property overnight.
Yes.
And I do remember, my mum having to pick me up from school and then walk me to this other house. And my stepmum was being so lovely to me. And she was my mum tells a story of when I fell over in the nettles, and my mum went to help me, and I said, "I don't want you, I want," and you know, it was my stepmum, which now I'm just like, oh. But it happened until my stepmum got pregnant herself. And then she'd got the house, she'd got the husband, she'd got the kids. Me and my brother were surplus to requirements. And she was passive aggressive. She was sarcastic. She ignored us. And it was, there were some quite painful moments to the point where when I was about nine, she just banned us from going to the house. So my dad had to sneak in, and my mum welcomed him into our house, and you know, on Sunday afternoons and stuff. But she used to sneak, he used to sneak in to see us so we could spend just an hour of our time together. So that kind of stuff, you know, that was my family unit, which was all upside down. And then just due to life and horribleness, I then lost touch with my dad when I was 13 and didn't see him again until I was 21, which caused me huge amounts of daddy issues and detachment and rejection, and got me into all kinds of relationships which were basically abusive, but I was just looking for love. But then there was also other things that were going on around this time. So my cousin had a baby who died of cot death after 9 months. So that was just really traumatic. And also, which I didn't realise, the legacy, my other cousin, I don't remember him, but when I was two, he got, it was on the day of Earl Mountbatten when he got assassinated by the IRA. My cousin was also killed by the IRA on that same day. So there was also this huge amount of grieving and fear and hatred almost that was in that cocktail. But on the other side, it was optimism, the skunks, you know, we're alive another day, keep on going. So lots and lots of weird stuff that happened to me. So when my friend said to me, "You've never had any pain, nothing's ever happened." And I'm like, actually, there's been quite a lot of stuff to unpack.
But it is interesting, isn't it? I mean, that it is phenomenal what you've said, because obviously, you know, we know so much about how the childhood affects who we are as an adult. I mean, we kind of carry it with us, don't we, until we sort it out. And it's interesting, isn't it, that your friend clearly did not pick up any of that from your whole demeanor. But so looking back, do you think that you were in sort of denial of it, or do you think in some respects being a child and being so young for it, sometimes, you know, children almost cruise through things because they just don't see the deeper level meanings of what's going on. And what do you think was going on for you?
Yeah, I think I got my survival techniques very, very quickly. And also because I didn't know any different as such, that was just my normality. Apart from my stepmom, who was just weird, she had her own problems. Actually, everybody loved me. So although we didn't talk about any of those issues, I knew that I was loved. And my new stepfather, who's, you know, still my stepfather now, was so nurturing and so kind, and yeah, just took the time to teach me things and empower me. So although I went through all of this quite traumatic stuff, I think because I knew that I was loved and I was supported and I was cared for, it gave me that resilience. And I've always said that my values are independence but support, which often don't go hand in hand. But I think that's what it's given me, that I can go out there in the world and survive even in the most strange and weird times, but as long as I've got a network around me. Had I not had that network, and if my parents were all wrapped up in their own stuff, I think I'd have been a very different person.
I think that's actually a really interesting point, because I certainly find with the clients that I work with therapeutically, the was I loved, was I not loved, you know, it's absolutely the core question. And I remember in my training, you know, our trainer saying it, you know, we all have that belief, don't we? I am loved and I'm worthy, or I'm not loved and I'm not worthy. And he said, you know, almost every problem that you deal with will come down to that. And I think that that's really fascinating, because you're right. I think I am loved and I'm worthy. It just, it enables you to almost not sail through, but to go through those challenges, because you believe that, you know, these people around me love me. It doesn't matter what happens. There's somebody around for me. And I think that's an incredibly powerful belief.
Yeah, and it's carried me through. And yes, during my teenage years when I was probably horrible to my parents and, you know, the typical teenager.
Yeah.
Even then I knew that I was still safe and I could kick out and I could do all these awful things and still be safe. And so, yeah, when I went to uni and then when I moved in a different city and all these other things, I just felt like actually it's not that I'm invincible, but I will be okay. And I always used to say, look, what's the worst that can happen? If something happened to me, I could go to any one of my aunts and uncles or cousins, knock on their door and they'd give me a place to stay.
Yeah.
So I think there is something really, foundational about that love and that support. But that said, I still went through my 20s and 30s very much looking to replace that hurt child of my father. So my father's rejection of me at 13, that really did have an impact. And I didn't know it at the time.
Yeah.
And I kept repeating behaviours, going for the wrong kind of people, even though they were nice people or appeared to be nice people.
Yeah.
They were wrong for me because I was just looking for a man to love me.
Yeah.
So my females got that sorted and my wider family. But yeah, unfortunately, that's something that did cause me a lot of pain. So I got married. So I met my future partner, my future husband at 18. And I went off to university and was expecting to have like this wild free time. And he jacked in his job and followed me and just landed on my doorstep at the halls of residence.
Right.
And I just didn't, I didn't want to be rejected again. So everything that then became in our relationship was all about me trying to please him so he wouldn't leave me. And although I was strong and optimistic, I was a people pleaser because I knew what it felt to have the man I loved not be with me anymore.
Yes.
So yeah, we got married at 22. And even though, you know, my family were saying, what are you doing? You know, you're far too young. I was like, I know better.
Yeah.
I really didn't know any better. And yeah, you know, the marriage was amazing in the sense that we had two wonderful children. And through our 20s, we had a wonderful life together. Well, you know, as good as any marriage could be. But then when I got to my 30s, it was like the world or the trauma or whatever it was started catching up with me. And yeah, I basically went through a thrisis, you know, I quit my job, quit my marriage, sold my house and almost just started again. And I think that was based on the trauma of being the good girl, trying to get love and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, that's fascinating. And it definitely sort of resonates with me, sort of the going into the wrong relationships with people who, you know, like say, you know, might be quite nice people, but they're just not actually you, but they are the person that would stay. So when I look back, you know, I think, you know, I have two sort of lovely ex-husbands from sort of almost decade long marriages. They're both lovely people, but actually chalk and cheese to what I actually needed. So I fully resonate with that. And I think there's something interesting I notice in clients kind of in their 20s to their 30s, there is a sort of maturity, I think you hit at 30. And I always say to my kids, you know, because I've got three sort of coming up on the 30 now and one that's just tipped over. But, you know, I always just say to them, for me, your 20s is like that exploration decade.
Yeah.
Who am I? What do I like? What do I want? And I said to them in that, I think you're kind of meant to have almost two or three relationships where you can then come out at 30 and kind of go, right, I need this and I need this and I need this for me to be happy. You know, these things are quite nice if I can get them. But that's kind of, you know, my five key things. And I think that people who don't do that through their 20s, they don't get to that kind of level of feeling good about themselves.
Yeah.
You know, for me, it was, I kind of did that at 40, not 30, you know, it kind of had another sort of disastrous relationship through my 30s. And so I think it's interesting. I always say to the people in their 20s, you know, just go out and live, just go out and try stuff, do stuff.
Don't commit.
And actually just, you know, the minute a relationship and you've kind of worked at it and it starts to feel not quite right, then look at it and go, what felt good? What didn't feel so good? Because then you learn about yourself. And so I really resonate with that feeling of sort of coming out of it all. I love your thrisis. I think that's a brilliant way of terming it. But just to go back, interestingly, to that comment that your friend made, I'm just, and this is pure curiosity, but I'm interested, how did that affect your friendship, that comment?
Well, I was furious, really furious. And to be honest, it hit me so hard because I still remember it today. It's like crystal clear. And, you know, I could see the pain that she was in because of multiple miscarriages. Yeah. And there I was, you know, with my second child on the way. So I had a huge amount of empathy for her. But I was also really fearful that maybe we wouldn't ever get past this. If she didn't ever get pregnant, how would that be? Yes. So there was a bit of fear going on. And there was a lot of anger that after all this time, you know, we'd lived together at university. We'd been friends for 9 years and really into each other's lives. And I thought, she hasn't ever really seen me.
Yeah.
She hasn't listened to my stories, or she hasn't really understood what I've been going through. That hurt a lot. Now, as it turned out, about a month or two later, she got pregnant with twins and we raised our children together. And our relationship went in a whole other direction. And interestingly, I brought the topic up with her. She doesn't even remember saying the comment.
No. And that's often the way, isn't it? I know, again, when I'm working with clients, it's a phrase that someone said and you think, gosh, you know, I might have said that as a parent, or, you know, it's probably just a phrase they said without even thinking. Yeah. And yet it just literally registers. In fact, we had a similar thing. My daughter went off to do her theory test for driving. And her older brother, trying to give her confidence, said to her, oh, come on, you know, you're just stupid if you don't pass it. And when she left, I said to him, oh my gosh, why did you say that to her? That's the sort of comment people in their 40s come back with, you know, no self-worth. And he said, oh, okay. And then she failed it. So I messaged him and said, you're going to have to mend this comment somehow, you know. So he was kind of having a laugh with her about it last night.
But it's so true. Sometimes these throwaway comments, just said in the spur of the moment, whether to be helpful or to actually express whatever, they can really land. Yes. And so we've had the conversations about it since. And because she's had, you know, her life since then has been quite traumatic. And now we can actually sit in the pain and also laugh about our joys together. But at that point, it was a real crossroads that we were on very different paths. And to be fair, you know, after that period, because she is my person, she's, you know, my special person. But even after my marriage broke down and we got all into the throes of children and everything, we did drift slightly. And but I think that was more for the fact that after my marriage broke down, my husband, my ex-husband, was almost, well, homeless as such. He'd left the family home, and he went to stay with them. So of course she was only hearing his side of the story and everything. And so that put a wedge until we did get back together and really discuss it. So I think she was in her early 30s. We were all in that transition period. But yeah, we found our way back together. It's a beautiful story.
That's really lovely. And I think actually it sort of brings me onto the topic of repair, because I think I was saying to a client the other day, in some respects, yes, go back and clear all your stuff. You know, obviously I believe hugely in that. But actually there's a point where repair becomes the thing that you're actually trying to learn to hone. It's not getting it all perfect, because that's never, ever going to happen. It's allowing yourself to not sit in whatever's going on, but to say, okay, so this has happened and I validate that experience, but what's the repair, you know, for me to get back to being myself? You know, so I love that story.
I think you, what you've just said there is probably the philosophy of my life. And I hadn't realized it as such, but it is a case of, yeah, this stuff happened to me, but what can I learn from it? What can I do with this information? Where do I find myself now, and how can I make it better? So I always see everything as a gift.
Yes.
But, you know, certain things you do need to repair. So me and my ex-husband, although it was all a bit yucky to start off with, we're now friends and we co-parent together. And when he's having issues or problems with his boss or whatever it is, we support each other in that sense. And we've really repaired that relationship. And I think for us, it was about going back and remembering, what were the reasons why we fell in love with each other? What was it I liked about you? When you take away all the stuff that I didn't like, actually, can we build a new relationship based on all of that stuff? And it was the same with my best friend, you know. There was something there that brought us together in the first place, and it's just now on different terms. But then I said to you, you know, that came to my 40s and everything just went upside down. I did a whole rebound thing after my marriage broke up, and within 10 months I'd moved this new fella into my house. And again, I just need, I wasn't used to, I'd never been on my own without a bloke around as such. I moved him in and it was hard. He'd got loads of guilt and he was actually depressed. But the love bug of being with me brought him out of that depression temporarily, only for him to go back into it. And it was very, very toxic. I think I saw the signs, but I didn't want to have another failed relationship and everything, to the point where everything that I wore, going out, who I spoke to, which friends I hung around with, everything was controlled. And I thought that would never happen to me. If and I always say, if anybody ever beat me up or whatever, touched me, I'd be out of there. But I didn't notice the emotional manipulation, the emotional control. And so we were actually together about 6 years, and it was, I remember it was the month before my 40th birthday, and he decided that as a punishment or whatever it was that he wanted to give to me, I wasn't allowed to touch him or have any physical contact with him in any way. And I remember lying in bed, absolutely afraid of rolling over in case I touched him by accident. And I just burst into tears at like 4 o'clock in the morning, and he woke up and he said, "What on earth?" And I said, I'm done. I cannot do this anymore. And he just put on his trousers, walked out, and that was it. And I never contacted him. And he, we spoke some months later, and he said, well, he was expecting me to go chasing after him, and I never did. I was just like, wow. But as a result of that, you know, I found myself living in a two-bedroomed house. Thankfully, it was my parents' rental, and they managed to get it for me. But I was sleeping on a sofa bed. My girls were upstairs. And I'd spent so much time and energy working on the relationship, and I hadn't got any clients or gotten the money, and it was, everything was unraveling. And then the repair started coming. And rather than just moving on to another relationship or thinking things are going to be better, I actually had to sit with processing the pain of what I've been through. So I repaired myself first. And that's the first time I'd ever tried that approach on me as such. And it was amazing, life-changing.
I think, I mean, it's back to that whole self-worth thing, isn't it? You have to love yourself and like yourself enough that you can say, I am worth it. And it's all from the core outwards, isn't it, that you start to heal your whole life. Because actually, it's interesting. I've been recording the audio of my book this week, and there was a line that really stuck out to me. And it says, you know, that in business, you have to know, like, and trust someone to buy, you know, from them. And if you don't know, like, and trust yourself, how are you going to buy you? And it was just a really interesting line. As I was kind of rereading it, I was thinking, yeah, that's so powerful, isn't it? That actually, because if you don't like yourself, then you're going to let people treat you in a way that you're uncomfortable with, because you're so desperate for them to like you because you don't like yourself. And I think it's so powerful, and I think a lot of people don't recognize that. And actually, I always say to clients, if you had to scale yourself out of 10 and 10 was how much you like yourself, what would it be? And the amount of people say, oh, maybe like a 3-4. And I'm sort of, what's missing, you know, in that 6? And I think it's really interesting that when you explain to them, this isn't perfection, this is just liking yourself. So you might say, oh my gosh, there's so much about me that I want to change, or, you know, I'm deeply flawed right now, but I'm aware of it and I'm kind of working better. I said, then to me, you're like a 9.5, 10. Because you're just saying, yeah, I'm on it. You know, I'm trying to sort it out. And I think that's so powerful, that bit where you have to stop in your life and say, you know, I don't like myself, or I'm not happy with myself. And actually, you have to start to find, you know, to love yourself. And it's interesting, in this comedian's book, she talks about the same thing. It went through a really, really difficult, very, very difficult kind of younger years, difficult childhood. And she said, you know, 87, she just loves who she is, you know, doesn't have a partner, loves her life, and just moves forward. And I think, I you know, I was saying before we started that, you know, I've got a couple of clients at the moment struggling with the kind of what ifs. You know, what if I hadn't married this person? What if I hadn't gone in this job? You know, what if everything had been different? And I've been trying to kind of explain, but actually, if we rolled life all the way back, you would still make that choice. You know, and one of them was saying, but I knew at that time that I wasn't sure that was the right decision. And I said, oh my gosh, you know, how many decisions do we all make that we're like, oh, I'm not sure this is the right decision. You know, and you just make it, don't
you?
It's
a flip of the coin, isn't it? And it, it's what you do with it once you go down that path. So yes, I knew that I shouldn't be, you know, getting married at 22 for all of those reasons. But my God, we had an amazing day. I looked beautiful in my wedding dress because I was a svelte 22-year-old with no wrinkles and the world ahead of me. We had an amazing honeymoon and we have two amazing children. So, yeah, you can go through all the what ifs. I wanted to go traveling. I wanted to spend a year or two going out and just being a bit of a hippie traveling around the world. It didn't happen. So I've just said, okay, well, when the children have left home, I'm going to do it then.
I think there's going to be a lot of 50-year-olds going around the world.
We'll be taking over Ibiza.
We will. Ibiza's quiet now at 9.
Exactly.
We've all gone to bed.
But it is that thing about, yes, you can look at all of the negative what ifs. What if this? What if that? But what about if you play it forward? But what if it worked? What if I did do this? What if I was happy? And the other thing that I just wanted to just come back to about, do you like yourself? One of the things that I realized was before this 40th year thing was I didn't like being by myself.
Yes.
So even when I was in the house, I had to have the radio on or I had to be busy doing stuff. And then through this process, I actually really learned to love my own company. And quite often I'll be working at home or even just watering in the garden with no noise.
Yes.
Just with my own thoughts. And I'm just in heaven. It's just blissful and joyful.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is one of the byproducts of loving yourself or actually just liking yourself. Is just in a state of just being, being present.
I love hearing you say that because I was exactly the same. So, you know, went into a relationship when I was kind of 15, 16 and have had, I mean, really, I could almost count it on one hand, you know, the amount of probably months I've had, you know, alone. And I'm the same. So over the last probably a couple of years, maybe a little bit before that, starting to realize actually I really liked my own time. And I think, you know, I love people, so I'm never going to be somebody who wants to spend, you know, weeks on their own. Although that slightly does appeal. But actually, like you, realizing that silence is lovely. And I'm quite strict now. So at 9, I say to my kids, you know, 15 and 17, you have to go upstairs. And they're like, why? And I'm like, because this is my time.
Yeah.
And it's my, you know, my glass of water, my cozy bit on the sofa, my TV program that I'm watching. This is my space. And my daughter said to me last night, Mum, you need to not be so fixed on having this time. And I was like, no, I do, because this is my space. And like you, I actually love that now.
Yeah.
And I think when you haven't grown up with that, and it probably sounds odd to some people who are like, really? I love being on my own. But when you find that, it is like finding a kind of, you know, the golden chalice almost, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you're just like, oh my gosh. It's like, for me, I felt it was like I'd grown up.
Yes. Yeah, no, I think it was the first time I really stepped into me, my body. It felt like everything just fit.
Yeah.
And that's not to say I haven't got all the other same challenges that everybody else has. And, you know, I've got two teenage daughters and, you know, you just imagine what that's like. And with them being in, you know, COVID, not having their prom, not seeing their friends, and, you know, running my own business and all of this kind of stuff. There's still chaos that goes on around me, but I feel grounded because I'm not actually worried about what do other people think of me. I'm not there to get approval from anybody else, and that's only come in the last few years, I'm not going to lie, but oh my God, it's a different energy.
Yes. And I think the same for me, it was definitely in my 40s. I found that. And I think it's almost as if when I look back at my other self, I don't understand the decisions that she made because I'm so far from her. I'm kind of going, I don't understand why you made that decision. But like you say, it's hugely powerful. And it's something, you know, I do want to talk about your work, but, you know, something I love seeing in clients as they move into that place where they're sort of, I really like who I am and I like my own time and I'm starting to care what I look like and what I do and who talks to me. And I literally love it because there's that tipping point, isn't there, when you're working with someone and you've seen it already, but they haven't seen it yet. And then they kind of message you or something. They're like, oh, this thing has happened, and you're it's like, oh magical. My gosh, it's so exciting. But I want you to tell us about your work, because I can see that a lot of this challenge led up to what you do. So tell us what you do, and also particularly why you're interested in the generation that you're interested in.
Yeah, so I wrote the book Leader X, and I've got a podcast by of the same name, because I work in leadership. Originally it was leadership coaching, now it's leadership and team development and working with cultures and things like that. But what I was really interested in was why is it that certain generations seem to just behave in completely different ways? And I saw this brilliant, I'm one of those 40 Gen Xers who is on TikTok, but I saw this brilliant TikTok video, and it got three penguins all flapping around hitting each other, and it got boomers, Gen Z and millennials, and then it just got Gen X stood there on its own with the Michael Jackson music, just leave me alone. And I was like, it is so right, because actually you do tend to get a lot of the generations, especially the millennials and the boomers, who just seem to just want to fight with each other.
Yeah.
And actually they've got very similar outlooks on life, but they just keep fighting. And then with Gen Z, so the younger ones, all under 20, they've probably been raised by our generation, the Xers. So we've taught them to be outspoken and to fight for their rights, a bit like, you know, when we were out there dancing to Prodigy and Nirvana and Rage Against the Machine. We've raised them like that. And there are these like cyclical elements that happen with any of this, but we are also really impacted by our environment. So again, for my generation, I grew up as the 80s kid.
Yeah.
So I remember the Cold War. I remember acid rain and Chernobyl. Yes. I remember the Zeebrugge and Hillsborough disasters. And one of the forming ones for me was actually the Ethiopian famine and Band-Aid. Yes. And all of these things really struck a chord with me. But also I remember AIDS, and I remember, you know, gay rights movements. And I suppose for my parents, it may have been, you know, the civil rights movements and stuff. So we're all really affected by our environment, and it really does shape the way that we perceive our values. And it really then starts talking about, you know, what does that look like in family dynamics? What does that look in the way that we parent our children? How does that matter when we lead people, when you've got four or five different generations? You know, we've allowed the millennials to sit at the dinner table and get involved in where would you like to go on holiday this year? What would you like for tea?
Yes.
And involve them. And then they get in the workplace and they're like, they just want to be involved in everything. Yeah. Why don't they just do as they're told? Well, that's how we've raised them. So for me, human dynamics and the social side of it, and how people just relate. And I have given this a lot of thought because, and I think a lot of it is to do with the fact that I had to learn to fit into different households with different values very, very quickly. But also me and my cousins, we used to just hang out all summer. You know, it was just our aunties while they were working, probably just get on with it. But we were different personalities, different ages. But we found a way of working together and creating fun and daring each other and whatever, and sorting out our conflict. So I think it's always been there for me. It fascinates me. Why do humans behave the way that they do, but much more in a social environment rather than with you? I suppose you work a lot more one-on-one. I like the team dynamics or the human dynamics together.
I think it's really interesting what you say about how we be bringing down that leadership. I remember working with some parents years ago, and they came in about, I think their daughter was about 13, and they were just so struggling with her. I mean, A, she reminded them of a sibling that they didn't get on with, both of them. So that, you know, dynamic was difficult. But, you know, this was obviously a really feisty young woman. And, you know, they sat there and kind of moaned about her for half an hour, which, you know, we all do. So I don't, you know, berate them for that. And I said, now, let me tell you what I hear, because I hear somebody who is the leader, somebody who's willing to stand up for what she believes in, somebody who, you know, if she wants change, she will actively go out and get it. And they just, their mouths hung open, and they said, oh, we just never saw her like that.
Wow.
You know, and they just hadn't seen that side of her. And I think, again, I remember you sort of running parenting classes, and I said to them, you cannot expect your child to follow the lead when they're now going through a school system which says you've got to stand up at the front and present, you've got to take a lead on this project, you've got to, you know, do kind of effectively an appraisal and set your own targets every year. You can't do that. And I always remember, for me, it was massively highlighted by the fact that schools, you know, we're constantly sending home this stuff saying, you know, let your child make their own decisions and let them take responsibility and all this sort of stuff. And then the school they were in wouldn't let them take their jumper off if they were hot. They had to ask for permission. And I was like, you can't.
You can't do this. And then, so we've got that at my daughter's school at the moment, and I'm it's a bit of a bee in my bonnet. Yeah. But the girls have to wear tights all year round. Oh, end of. And so I've written to the school, and I've and, you know, in my coaching style, I've tried to raise my perspective and heard back theirs, and they are just so fixed. They just cannot see any other perspective. No. So now I've actually, you know, I'm encouraging her to be a rebel. So she's turning up with her tights, but they've got holes in them. And apparently the headmistress just looks at her and turns the other way, because she knows that nowhere in the school uniform does it say that they have to be perfect tights.
Yes.
So I'm teaching them just to actually just question everything. Does this rule make sense? Is this policy okay with me? And if not, actually use your legal or your safe way to actually protest or raise the questions.
I agree. There were those boys recently, weren't there, who went to school in skirts.
Yeah,
we told they had to wear trousers, and it was what, 30 odd degrees, and then they were just saying this is crazy, so they went in skirts. And I think one of the things I see in society a lot is that we're not, you know, if you run your business, you're almost re-looking every 6 months. Does everything work? Is everything I'm doing right? But we have these things that have just been around for kind of 40 years, and people also actively don't want to look at them.
And which is why we get hashtags. Yeah. So now you've got the BLM came out of nowhere, which actually, if you were any kind of awareness, you'd have seen it coming. The Me Too movement came out of nowhere, but it didn't. We've been talking about it. And then people talking about, you know, well, it's Pride Month. You know, why is everyone suddenly talking about Pride? Like, actually, yes, it is always there, but we need to keep talking about it. So I think those companies that aren't listening to the younger generations, because, you know, a statistic that always sticks in my mind is by 2025, which isn't very far away, 56% of your consumers and your workplace is going to be under the age of 40. So that's those Gen Z and those millennials. Yes. They are outspoken. They do care about things because you've raised them that way.
Yes.
So when they speak up, rather than telling them that they're wrong, actually listen to them.
Yes, they are a force to be reckoned with. And I've noticed it just over the last sort of 10 years, I've noticed that client average of clients coming in at kind of 40 saying, oh, I've kind of lifted my head up and I want to look at my life. They're now 30.
Yeah.
And I think it's fascinating. And a lot of them actually coming in saying, I want to clear all my stuff because I want to have children. You know, they're seeing the effect, and they're so aware, like you say, they're so aware of everything. And they're actually saying, yeah, I need to sort myself out here because I've watched my parents sort themselves out after they had me, and that wasn't so useful.
And really interestingly, I write about this in Lead X, but people of my age group, when we first went into the world of work, this thing called coaching was just taking off. And I remember being, I think, 22 and going on my first grow model coaching course, but it just was the standard. This is how we do things around here. So again, we've parented in that way, but also it just feels so normal to us to actually collaborate and ask other people's points of view and to act as teamwork. And so now our generation are running the businesses or stepping up to the board. I do hope that there's going to be a fundamental change and that we listen and we collaborate and we enjoy being with each other and we stop, excuse my French, we stop working our shit out on other people.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, interestingly, the sort of companies that I've been working with recently, you know, they've got these lovely teams that are working really well together, but they've got an upper board level of people who are making the decisions who don't like change, don't want to move, you know, about to retire. And almost all of them, you know, saying to me, you know, can you come in and work with this team? But we've got a limit of what we can do kind of until those people leave.
Yeah.
And it's really sad, isn't it? Because it, because that, what's the word, that kind of innovation, that pressure, it's there. it's just waiting almost for that top lot to go, really.
And I'm seeing the same. And so I actually did my final manuscript in 2019. Mm. And the first chapter of the book says the 2020s will be the transformational decade.
Yeah.
Now, of course, I wasn't expecting COVID, but I could already see that, you know what, it might take 2 years, it might take 5 years, but by the end of the decade, there will be this leadership transformation where the Gen Xers and the older millennials will take those seats, and they still have the energy and the drive and the passion. But if they don't rise in the next few years, they will go and start their own companies. Yes. Somewhere else.
Yeah. And I definitely see that, as I'm sure you do, that people are just sort of saying, actually, I'm just not happy with the way that, you know, this is working. I'm going to go and do my own thing. And I think
COVID is accelerating that.
I think it has. Yeah, hugely so, actually. I think we've almost kind of gained a decade of people just saying, I want a quality of life. I want it to work like this. So back to your story. If you look back, what lessons do you think that you learned going through that drove you into doing your business, but also almost to the ones that come up for you? Because I know for me, there's a lot of my stuff, will come up with other people. And I think we have these kind of common themes. Mm. So do you see common themes from your life that you've kind of conquered it, but accepted it, you're able to kind of share? Do you see those coming up with your clients?
Yeah. So I'd say that there's a couple of key areas that do keep repeating. One is, that this is something I was guilty of. Why is it that I give all this freedom and all this empowerment, but people still don't do the work properly?
Yeah.
And what they don't realize is that they are impatient and they are frustrated and they are passing down that pressure to other people. So it creates a fear-based environment. Mm. So that they're saying, let's all collaborate and give me 10 ideas right now. it just doesn't work. So I recognize that. So that's the inner controller within me, and realizing that I needed to control my chaotic world around me. And that transferred into my own leadership until I realized it and did the work. The other one is, and it's not, I don't want to use the word imposter syndrome, but there's definitely something there about being the people pleaser.
Yeah.
So being afraid to use your voice or to put your head against above the parapet or to take some risks. So they feel it within them that something isn't right or that behavior isn't right, but they don't know how to turn that into whether it's words or action or just an inner confidence. And I think that's something that particularly the my generation and maybe a little bit below, because they have been in very autocratic businesses for so long, it's almost been trained into them, and it's breaking free of that. But again, I recognize it in myself, being the people pleaser, trying to fit in and make everyone happy. I'd say they're the two themes that are getting louder and louder.
Yeah, I would agree. I would wholly agree. And I think, when we don't have control as we grow up, we sort of try to grip onto it everywhere. And I can look back into my 20s and think, I was definitely guilty of kind of micromanaging other people. And I remember seeing a woman, it was a voluntary role, but I saw her about 8 years later and I said to her, can I just apologize for micromanaging you over this project we were on? And she said, oh my gosh, I never even, never thought about it, whatever. And she said, I can't believe you're apologizing for this. And I said, as soon as I noticed it, I said I wanted to apologize, and she was just laughing at me. But I agree with you, and I think control. And one of the things that I find stops them voicing what they want is their lack of communication skills. And I think, as a mediator, one of the things that I do is go into teams and teach them how to manage conflict, but just basically how to communicate, because I think people feel like if they stand up, they have to almost kind of stamp their feet and stand up. And I think this was actually, they can say, I'm wondering if, and it's just so much more gentle. And that's another change I love seeing in clients, when they start to be able to voice how they feel, whether it's at work or home, but they can voice it in that way that is not then antagonistic to other people. Yeah. And I'd love to sort of, go into schools and just teach communication, how to manage conflict, all this sort of stuff.
These are basic skills. And this is one of the things that when I do that, because one of my favorite courses that I do is called Courageous Conversations. And And I've said, look, we're sat here, you know, you're in your 30s, you're in your 40s. Yeah. But this stuff, this basic stuff that I'm teaching you, we should be learning as soon as we're entering into any kind of conversation. Yeah. And it's just, it's alien for people. Mm. But it's so simple.
I know. I always recommend the book Nonviolent Communication. Yeah. Because it's just such a lovely book, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think that was one of the precursors that actually got me into thinking, but there's another way. Yes. And one of the other books that I really love is Conversational Intelligence. Mm. And it's about the neuroscience of what's actually going on in the brain, and just with different, so it's not NLP as such, but it's the how to build trust and how to dial up certain behaviors and dial down others. So for your listeners, there's a couple of good books to go with.
So I'm going to go and have a look at that one. I haven't heard of that one either.
So
three questions that I ask every single guest. So normally I say, when you look back at your challenge, when I look back at your challenges, is there a book, a film, or a piece of music that has sort of stuck with you that really kind of reminds you of getting through either one or all of those challenges that you went through?
Bizarrely, and this is a childhood film, but it's actually the original Star Wars trilogies. And we used to watch them with my dad and my brother. It was our thing anyway. So it's got like that emotional attachment. Yeah, when I look back, it's not just the emotional attachment. It's actually the fact that the families are messy. Yes. And they meet all these other people who think differently, who look differently to them, and they teach something to each other. So I think that's probably, you know, my life story is a Star Wars kind of story. And of course, I'm Princess Leia.
Of course, we always wanted to be, didn't we? Yes. My first memory of that is my sister taking me and me just falling asleep, waking up as the credits ran. I was like, about 6 years old or something, but very little. Same with Greece as well, I think. Yeah. But so my second question is if there was something that people listening could do right now that you think actually go and do this and it will make a change, what would you recommend?
So this is one of the activities that I did. It was difficult, but it was worth it. And it was to write a list, and let's go for 20 things about yourself that you like. So rather than things that you hate about yourself or, you know, you don't like, actually 20 things you like or love about yourself. And I think that it just resets your perspective. Yeah.
That's lovely. I really like that, actually, coming from the positive rather than negative. That's really nice. And then my kind of third and final question is, if you were standing in front of the world leaders today, what would you say to them?
Do better, be kinder, take responsibility.
That's very nice. I like that a lot. Lucy, thanks for coming on and being so candid and sharing your story. I think it's incredibly powerful, but also incredibly powerful to look at the kind of, you know, the consecutive challenges that you've gone through, but also just the strength. It feels to me like you've kind of sucked the strength out of every single challenge. And, you know, you do have, you know, I was saying before the podcast, you do have an incredibly sunny disposition. You know, and I can imagine, you know, people thinking, oh, it must have been easy for her. But I've grown to learn, and I'm sure you probably think the same, that often the people that I think have kind of got it together the most have actually been through the most.
Yeah.
You know, there's something, it is almost like a glue that kind of helps you become this really solid version of yourself. Not to say you're not going to trip up and get things wrong, but that you become this very solid, very together. It's kind of like that penguin thing that you were saying, where it's just a kind of leave me alone. I'm fine on my own. You know, I'm kind of got this center core that's strong. I think it's fascinating. I definitely picked that up from you.
Oh no, that makes me really happy, because when I think about my archetype, I always think of the oak tree. It's got really strong roots, a really strong core, but it's also the home of the little acorns and any owl that wants to take a perch. And that's the way I want to see my life. And that's how I feel, like the oak tree.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Oh, I think it's really lovely. And if people want to find you in your book, how do they get hold of you?
Well, if you're on social media, you can just follow the hashtag LeaderX. And just search for Lucy Barkers. If you go onto Instagram, there are a few clones. So head over to LinkedIn. I'm the only one on there.
Brilliant. Well, big enough to be cloned. That's, you know, I think that's a mark of success. Lucy, thanks so much. And, you know, let's speak again soon.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Mary Williams, as you know, and thank you so much for listening to the Alternative Leader podcast. I search for guests to bring you lessons and learnings that can help move you forward in your life, help you achieve the success that you want to, in whatever way that shows up for you, to help you lead powerfully, whether that's in your own life, as your parenting, your personal, or your professional, and make you the best that you can be. If you've enjoyed the show, please rate and review it, and please share it with as many people as you think also want to move forward and gain success in their lives. If you want to find out more about me, go over to my website, which is www.mary-williams.com. That's www.mary, which is M-A-R-I-Williams.com, and you'll find links to all of my social media profiles there. There's also a Facebook community that you can join. And again, all the links will be on the website too. I hope you have an absolutely fantastic day. And thank you so much for listening.